All right, so for our second segment of Speculative Medievalisms and Attic Laboratory, we have Eugene Thacker from the New School, where he's an associate professor. Eugene's research focuses on the relation between media and philosophy. In addition to his writing on science and technology, he has published articles on Georges Bataille, Gilles Deleuze, Michel Foucault, Arthur Schopenhauer, and medieval mysticism. Thacker's most recent book, which I can tell you I'm eager to read myself, is After Life. And his previous books include The Exploit, A Theory of Networks, co-authored with Alexander Galloway, and Biomedia. He is currently working on a series of short books titled Horror of Philosophy. And without further ado, I give you Eugene Thacker, whose comments today are titled Divine Darkness.
Thanks. Thank you to Eileen and Babel and everybody for organizing this. As we were talking about before, it's always good to have these kind of venues where you're meeting people that you wouldn't otherwise meet because you're in different sectors of academia and whatnot. You have to forgive me if I'm a little tired, because this is actually like part three of a three-day conference for me. So I had paper yesterday and one before. If anybody was at the Dark Materialisms event on, feels like weeks ago.
Wednesday.
I'm going to be giving a version of that talk, but there are some differences, so I apologize if there's any repetition, unwelcome repetition. Okay. Nearly everyone can relate, I suspect, to the feeling of being scared of the dark. It is no doubt for this reason that darkness saturates the horror genre. From the earliest examples of gothic novels and graveyard poetry to the most recent films, comics, and video games. We do not know what it is that dwells in the darkness, only that our not knowing is a source of fear. Darkness seems to steadily creep forth, submerging everything in an anonymous pitch blackness. Our fear of the dark seems as ambiguous as darkness itself. This ambiguity is arguably at once horrific, and yet, because of its ambiguity, it also obtains the quality of the mystical. Georges Bataille notes this, writing about religious art. This is a quote. "What I suddenly saw, and what imprisoned me in anguish, but which at the same time delivered me from it, was the identity of these perfect contraries, divine ecstasy and its opposite, extreme horror." The concept of darkness evokes this combination of religion and horror, and it is the shift from the horror of something in the dark to the horror of darkness itself. Put simply, the concept of darkness invites us to think about this basic metaphysical dilemma of a nothing that is a something. From the time when Bataille, as a teenager, entered a Catholic seminary, which he promptly abandoned with great fervor, to his later experiments with the secret society Asphalt, to his last writings on religious art, one can trace these themes of mysticism, darkness, and negation running through nearly all of Bataille's works. Religion is, for Bataille, the practice whereby the discontinuous human being seeks out a continuity that can neither be experienced nor known, a continuity that exists before and after the life of the human being, a continuity that has both been lost and yet is never attained. This inaccessible continuity, neither empirical nor ideal, is what Bataille calls divinity. And divinity is, in short, for Bataille, that which is radically unhuman, and this is the direction that I'm going to be pushing Bataille in. The divine is, for Bataille, that which stands outside of subject-object relations altogether. The most basic distinctions between life and death, for instance, are dissolved in the anonymous continuity that Bataille terms the divine. As Bataille notes, using the example of religious sacrifice, it's a quote, "Death reveals life in its plenitude and darkens the order of the real." For Bataille, the divine negates the anthropomorphic sovereign God as much as it does the individuated human being. The divine is the horizon of the human. The divine is the impossibility human. Humanity, defined by its inauguration of the subject-object split, attempts to recapture its lost continuity, or vitae, through the rituals of sacrifice, war, and consumption. The endpoint of such rituals, from a religious standpoint, is the dissolution of subject and object that has become the hallmark of divine continuity. But at the same time, the human being must maintain a minimal distance, and thus discontinuity, in order to possibly experience and comprehend, to circumscribe, the divine as such. It appears that divine continuity can only have a negative character, can only be intuitable to us as an enigmatic something that recedes into shadows, obscurity, and darkness. The divine is in this way the blind spot of the human. I'm going to read another quote. This is from also from Bataille. But how, even for a moment, can I dismiss this unknowing, a feeling of having lost my way in some underground tunnel? To me, this world, the planet, the starry sky are just a grave. I don't know if I'm suffocating here, if I'm crying, or becoming some kind of incomprehensible sun. Even war can't light up a darkness that is this total. This is a dilemma that Bataille refers to as mediation. And in passages like this, the boundaries of the human become fuzzy and obscure, at once tomb-like and yet planetary and even cosmic. The darkness that Bataille evokes has a number of precedents in the mystical tradition. Dionysus the Areopagite, for instance, asks how we can know the ray of divine darkness, Theon Scotus Activa. Dionysus presumes a concept of darkness that is neither simply privative nor oppositional, but also distinct from the more familiar mystical tropes of light, illumination, and radiation. I'm going to read a short quote from the Mystical Theology. The fact is that the more we take flight upward, the more our words are confined to the ideas we are capable of forming. So that now, as we plunge into that darkness, which is beyond intellect, we shall find ourselves not simply running short of words, but actually speechless and unknown. In spite of the fact that Dionysus brings us to the point of silence, where there's nothing to say, this, of course, has not had the effect of silencing mystical discourse. In fact, the opposite is the case. A thinker like Meister Eckhart will take Dionysus' notion that there is nothing to say quite literally, as in nothing or nothingness is the only thing to say when one speaks of the divine. In his commentary on Exodus, Eckhart outlines four basic types of mystical darkness. There is first a darkness as an indicator that one is, in Eckhart's words, in tribulation. That is, darkness is a symptom of a spiritual crisis that leads one to seek out the divine. Perhaps we can call this the darkness of despair. Second, there is a darkness that, as an indicator that one is, again in Eckhart's words, with tribulation, or with the divine in tribulation. This is a spiritual duration of one in suffering and in prayer. Perhaps we can call this the darkness of suffering. Third, there is a darkness that creates confusion about what to do, that causes one to be caught, in Eckhart's words, between prosperity or adversity. Here one is caught between a conditional relation to the divine, based on reward or punishment, and an unconditional relation, irrespective of an outcome in the world. We can perhaps call this the darkness of the world. So with these first three types of darkness, Eckhart describes the contours and limits of the human. The human arrives at a point of tension, poised between a relation to the world that would preserve the human via a religious economy of debt, reward, and punishment, and a relation to the world that would negate the boundary between the human and the not human. And this leads to the fourth and final type of darkness that Eckhart describes, and this is a short quote. Further and forth, The darkness can be understood as the immensity and surpassing excellence of the divine light into the surpassing light that beats down and darkens our intellect. This fourth type of darkness is the moment when one basically gives up, or really is given up. In Eckhart's words, one empties oneself so that nothing remains except darkness. For Eckhart, the divine paradoxically makes itself accessible in its inaccessibility, as something that presents itself as absolutely beyond the human and thus as nothing. As Eckhart notes in one of his sermons, you cannot do better than to place yourself in this darkness and in unknowing. This sort of preoccupation with the limit of the human finds one of its most dramatic manifestations in John LaCrosse's poem, The Dark Night of the Soul. As I said before, I really like John because he had the wherewithal to provide commentary for his own poetry, so for academics, it's really easy. John provides a more streamlined typology than Eckhart, distinguishing between two types of darkness, a darkness of the senses and a darkness of the soul. But we risk a great misunderstanding if we read John as advocating a direct human experience of the divine, experience as testimony, in other words. For John, mystical experience does not reaffirm or bolster the human subject, quite the opposite. Mystical experience is dark precisely because it is that which cannot be experienced. It is the impossibility of experience. This point is made more clearly when John hints at a third type of darkness, and he really never names this or discusses this in detail, but a third kind of darkness that lies beyond the darkness of the senses or the darkness of the soul. And this is also a quote. The clearer and more obvious divine things are in themselves, the darker and more hidden they are to the soul naturally. Hence, when the divine light of contemplation strikes souls not yet entirely illumined, it causes spiritual darkness, for it not only surpasses them, but also deprives and darkens their act of understanding. This is why St. Dionysius and other mystical theologians call this infused contemplation a ray of darkness. John's evocation of the dark night and the impossibility of its experience brings us back to the work of Bataille. The writings of the darkness mysticism tradition exercised a great influence on Bataille's writings, particularly during the 40s and 50s when he's working on his A Theological Summa. And these influences can be readily detected in the pages of some of his published works, such as Inner Experience. And I'm going to read a short quote from Inner Experience where he will cite Denys, Eckhart, and John throughout the work. Bataille says, positive theology, founded on the revelation of the scriptures, is not in accord with this negative experience, the negative experience of darkness mysticism. He continues, in the same way, I hold the apprehension of God to be an obstacle in the movement which carries us to the more obscure apprehension of unknowing, of a presence which is no longer in any way distinct from an absence. I would suggest that Bataille's mystical writings are not simply a ventriloquizing of mystical authors, and neither are they simply about the existential crisis of the human subject. With a thinker like Bataille, they tend to run the gamut from the most basic forms of base materialism and inorganic matter to the planetary and even cosmic cycles of production, accumulation, and expenditure. That is, this kind of darkness mysticism, I think, has to be placed in the context of Bataille's own version of political economy. In the same way that divine darkness is in excess of the individuated human being, so is there a divine darkness that is in excess of the world, at least the world that we as human beings construct for us and fashion in our image. Divine darkness is precisely this negation that cuts across self and world, the human and the non-human. Not by virtue of a bountiful, vitalistic life force, but by way of a process of emptying and darkening. In an almost Lovecraftian vein, Bataille notes the following: beyond our immediate ends, humanity's activity in fact pursues the useless and infinite fulfillment of the universe. And one passage from Bataille's poem, L'Arche Angélique, the Arch Angelical, reads, "The excess of darkness is the flash of a star. The cold of the tomb is a dye." And in fact, much of Bataille's poetry bears an incredible similarity to John of the Cross in its sort of minimalism and in its economy. In Bataille's mystical poetry, the eye of the poem immediately dissolves and is entombed into a kind of planetary climatological materialism, just as the anonymous base materialism of the world courses through and is inseparable from the eye. But clearly this is no hippie love-in. For Bataille, as for Dionysus, Eckhart, and John of the Cross, all roads of the via negativa lead to darkness, an absolute limit of the human capacity to circumscribe self and world. That's another short quote from Inner Experience. Bataille says, "I imagine that it is as in vision, which is rendered sharp in darkness by the dilation of the pupil. Here, darkness is not the absence of light or of sound, but absorption into the outside." And the term here that he uses here is le dehors. Now, this outside that Bataille evokes is not some kind of ideal other place, much less the experience of a transcendent beyond. That is, this darkness that is outside is not above or beyond. It is a limit that is coextensive with the human at its limit. And this is why I think Bataille's project is interesting. It does not attempt to pass beyond the human, whether we call it the transhuman or the posthuman. It also does not attempt to undermine the human, be it in terms of objects, actants, or techniques. But in borrowing from the darkness mysticism tradition, Bataille's texts opt to darken the human, or to maybe undo the human, by paradoxically revealing the shadows and the nothingness at its core, to move not towards a renewed knowledge of the human, but towards something we can only call an unknowing of the human, or really the unhuman. Bataille's mysticism, then, is a mysticism of the limits of the human, and this divine darkness would be something like a mysticism of the unhuman. So what I'd like to do with the time left is shift gears a little bit and sort of offer three modes of this sort of divine darkness. And I don't see these as mutually exclusive at all. In fact, I think they're all sort of co-present, but in different sort of degrees or intensities, depending on the text or the author one's dealing with. The first kind is the one that's most familiar to us, probably, and this I'll call a dialectical darkness. Dialectical darkness entails a concept of darkness that is inseparable from some opposing term. And we might say there's three types. There's an epistemological variant of this, ignorance and knowledge. There's a metaphysical variant, absence, presence. And there's a theological variant, privation, gift. Dialectical darkness always subsumes darkness within its opposing term. And in this sense, darkness is always subordinate to something that opposes or comes after darkness. With dialectical darkness, the movement is from a negative to an affirmative experience of the divine, from the absence of any experience at all to a fully present experience. But this fully present experience also comes at the cost of a sort of surreptitious underground negation. For instance, vision, visio, it's, you know, the seeing or facing is a moment of presence, but also requires a sort of extraction to sort of turn around and face. Same with ecstasy, ecstasis standing outside, and rapture, raptus being snatched away, and so on. All these modes of affirmation entail a sort of underground negation. Dialectical darkness is incredibly recuperative and all-encompassing, so it has this kind of quality to it. It's recuperative even of concepts of darkness that claim to pass beyond the opposition of light and dark. Dialectical darkness is at once the ground of but also the obstacle for any concept of darkness. A second kind I'll call superlative darkness. Superlative darkness is darkness precisely because it lies beyond the dialectical opposition of dark and light, or it claims to. Paradoxically, superlative darkness surpasses all attempts to directly or affirmatively know the divine. Hence, superlative darkness contains a minimal philosophical commitment to a superlative transcendence. Beyond any experience of light, that is a kind of anti-empiricist thread, beyond any concept of light, a kind of anti-idealist thread. And thus you get contradictory phrases, the light beyond light, the brilliant darkness, the ray of divine darkness, and so on. With superlative darkness, there's a movement from an affirmative to a superlative experience of the divine, from simple affirmation to an affirmation beyond all affirmation. And we might even call this a cataphatic darkness. We should note that with superlative darkness, we are brought to a certain limit, not only of language, but of thought itself. The motif of darkness comes in here to indicate this limit. And it's a horizon that haunts nearly every concept of darkness, this possibility of thinking the impossible. Okay, so what I want to suggest here is, or what I want to sort of pose, I guess, as a question, is whether there's a third kind of darkness, perhaps one that we see in Bataille and maybe reading backwards through Bataille in this darkness mysticism tradition that I've been calling divine darkness. And this play between the possible and the impossible brings us to yet another stage. Divine darkness questions the metaphysical commitment of superlative darkness. And really this means questioning its fidelity to the principle of sufficient reason. Now the interesting thing about superlative darkness is that while it may subscribe to a minimal version of the principle sufficient reason, it does not presume that we as human beings can have a knowledge of this reason. That everything that exists has a reason for existing may be the case, but whether or not we can know this reason is another matter altogether. Superlative darkness is an attenuated variant of the principle of sufficient reason, and really, maybe here we should talk about the principle of sufficient divinity or something. If we could do this, principle of sufficient divinity would have two parts to it. There would be a statement about being, that something exists, even though that something may not be known by us, and is therefore nothing for us as human beings. And a statement on logic, that something that exists is ordered and therefore intelligible, though perhaps not intelligible to us as human beings. And it's both of those caveats that I think make this a divine principle of sufficient divinity instead of sufficient reason. Superlative darkness still relies on a limit of the human as a guarantee of the transcendent being and logic of the divine, or that which is outside the human. The limit of human knowing becomes a kind of backdoor means of knowing human limits, resulting in a sort of conciliatory knowledge that one finds in many of the mystical texts. Now, I wonder if divine darkness would take this and make of it a limit as well. And this would involve distinguishing two kinds of limit within darkness mysticism, generally speaking. There is first the limit of human knowing. Darkness is the limit of the human ability to comprehend that which lies beyond the human, but which, as beyond the human, may still be invested with being, order, and meaning. This then leads to a second-order knowing of this unknowing. And here, darkness indicates this conciliatory ability to comprehend the incomprehensibility of what remains outside the human. Then, secondly, there's the limit of that which cannot be known by us, the limit of the limit, as it were. With the limit of human knowing, the first type, there is still the presupposition of something outside that is simply a limit for us as human beings. But the limit of a limit is not a constraint or boundary. Maybe it's a darkening of this principle of sufficient divinity, It suggests that there is nothing outside and that nothing outside is also absolutely inaccessible. This seems to lead not to a conciliatory knowledge of unknowing, which is really a knowing of something that cannot be known. Instead, it seems to lead to a negative knowing of nothing to know. There is nothing and it cannot be known. So if we were to summarize these points, we could say the following. Divine darkness is the conjunction of these two kinds of limits, the limit of human knowing and the limit of that which cannot be known. And if superlative darkness is a cataphatic darkness, then this, of course, would be an apophatic darkness. There's nothing to know, and it cannot be known. Divine darkness is therefore the unknowing of nothing. Okay, last words. In what we've been calling darkness mysticism tradition, a concept of negation is put forth that is tied some way to the motif of darkness, although darkness is not always negative for each of these thinkers. This divine darkness, or really a mysticism of the unhuman, is not in any way an answer, much less a solution, to some of the issues we face today concerning the post-human, or what Bataille once called the congested planet. And perhaps one of its greatest lessons is the one repeatedly stated by Eckhart, that this darkness, in its unknowing, is not separate from us. Not separate from us, but really within us as well. It is not a darkness out there and a great beyond, but something like an outside, le dehors, to use Bataille's term, an outside that is coextensive with the human at its absolute limit. It runs the gamut from the lowest to the highest, from the micro scale to the macro scale, from the human to the unhuman. It is a sentiment echoed by Bataille when he speaks about this type of darkness as a form of impossibility. And this is a quote I'll end with. But he says, "I enter into a dead end. There all possibilities are exhausted. The possible slips away and the impossible prevails. To face the impossible, exorbitant, indubitable, when nothing is possible any longer, is in my eyes to have an experience of the divine." And I'll stop there. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, we're now going to have a response from Nicola Machandaro, who is an associate professor at Brooklyn College. He is a bewildered medievalist currently interested in spontaneity, commentary, and radical perfectionism. Last year's publications include The Sorrow of Being, Individuation, This Stupidity, which someone on the internet voted the best title of an essay of the year last year.
No, they like the abstract.
Oh, the abstract, the best abstract of the year, right.
Better than the piece itself.
Right, I'm sorry. Well, that was published in the inaugural issue of Postmedieval on the Posthuman. Another article he co-authored with Anna Klosowska, who's with us here today, Between Angels and Acteon, Dislocation. Another essay, Anti-Cosmosis, Black,
Mahapralaya.
Ah, thank you. One of my favorite essays of Nicola's, which was published in Collapse, which is a kind of journal of creative philosophy that's published in Falmouth by Robin McKay of Urbanomic, who was actually, I forgot to mention at the beginning, one of the kind of progenitor spirits of this event. He kind of suggested it, but he couldn't be with us today, unfortunately. And they published Nicola's article, Becoming Spice, Commentary as Geo-Philosophy. Without further ado, here is Nicola.
Thank you. I'm glad for this opportunity to respond to Eugene on mysticism, particularly with regard to commentary, because he and I will be co-editing an issue of the journal Glossator, you know, devoted to commentary on mystical texts. So this is already participation in that project. My comments will try to do a few things. I guess one really to just kind of draw out and gloss the potentiality of Eugene's reading of the divine darkness tradition I'm going to do this by focusing on a series of parallel distinctions, which I think are present in Eugene's presentation, the distinction between that and what, the distinction between soul and body, soul, maybe life and body. But I'm going to kind of push these in the direction of the distinction between thought and experience and be thinking about darkness as the relation, this blind spot, as the kind of occluded relation between thought and experience. At the same time, I want to push the concept of divine darkness back into what I think is the traditional project of mystical contemplation, which is to become God, to achieve union with God. And I think that's a desire which is certainly legible in Bataille's project, but which one that Bataille also has to refuse. And there's a kind of reification of the limit, you know, of experience. And therefore, I think necessarily in Bataille, a mystification of mysticism. My figure for sort of for the way I'm seeing my response to Eugene on divine darkness is the figure of the cephalophore, the head-bearing saint. Of course, Saint Denis or Dionysus, the Areopagite, was himself a cephalophore. And I'll try to suggest, I probably won't really get to spelling this, that I'll try to suggest that the cephalophore should be reinvented by speculative medievalists as a kind of ideal for precisely this congested humanity. I think my favorite term is we're living in the Anthropocene, the age of man, where sort of humanity is literally run amok, and that is the dead end, right? On the global scale that Eugene ended with. So I've just titled my comments "Per Speculum in Enigmate," or through a glass darkly, as it's typically translated. I'd just like to note from the beginning that there's an intimate relation between the mirror and beheading. That when we look into a mirror, we are sort of non-violently beheaded, right? The significance of divine darkness and darkness in general is inseparable from the distinction between thought and experience. In the basic scenario of being afraid of the dark with which Eugene began, this distinction is made clear in the conflict between what we know and what we feel of the dark, a conflict one may try to resolve with self-reminders that the fear is irrational or ungrounded in real knowledge, or that the specifically frightful movie scene is an illusion or at least merely film footage. But in the example, wherein, quote, the shift from the horror of something in the dark to the horror of darkness itself is really never completed, but always underway in a manner that compounds rather than displaces the horror, such that the darkness becomes doubly horrible, the magnified synthesis of an unpredictable violent potentiality out of which something might get you, and an abyssic void into which one might slip and fall. In this example, darkness also reveals its strange power to join thought and experience in ways they could never connect themselves. That is, in being something inseparable from the distinction between thought and experience, darkness is by the same virtue exactly what joins them in unforeseeably and supra-discursively, in a manner that arrives or seems to arrive marked from a place one cannot think or talk one's way towards, a space one can enter only alonely via a terrifying or torturous event. And this is the in what's been called in the fourth volume of Collapse by George Sieg, the gnosis of the victim, right? So in cinematic, the cinematic image is like in Psycho, right, where the camera eye is sort of occupied by the eye of the victim, who alone can see. I think the film Martyrs, which some of you may have also seen, really is revisiting the Bataille tradition of this idea of the gnosis of the victim. Okay, so for Bataille, this singular gnosis of the victim is a kind of decapitation. He writes, the human being arrives at the threshold. There he must throw himself headlong, vivant, living, into that which has no foundation and has no head. Beheading was essential for Bataille, who clearly intuited its esoteric significance as real symbol of mystical union. The unlocatability or non-appearance of a real headsman for Asifal's human sacrifice perfectly figuring the godlessness, though certainly not the undivinity, of his mysticism. In terms of Christianity, we may recall how beheading operates as the moment of the crowning of a martyr, and of course, John the Baptist is the kind of ur-martyr in that sense, though he's precisely not a martyr, that is, he's not a witness to the faith, but he sort of occupies also the role, we might think of the heretic or the possible heretic, right? The one who has to kind of get out of the way for the true God to appear. There's a confusion between John and Christ in terms of their followers. So I'm also interested in maybe also through La Ruelle, the figure of the heretic, the one who says, I am God. You know, what is the politics of the person who says, I am God? Okay, so according to the phenomenological principle voiced by Heidegger and demonstrated in the ancient literal meaning of symbolon, symbol, that a severing is also a joining, beheading elegantly performs the operation of the dark as a separation of thought and experience that opens them to a new relation, an opening from within into a new absolute, what Reza Nagaristani calls a line of openness that slashes through the God, the human, and the earth. Just to clarify, remember the symbolon, sometimes it's like a bone, like if you have a contract, right, you would break a bone, one person keeps up. So the idea is that actually by severing these things, you discover this new intimate kind of relation that inhabits this distance, right? So I'm suggesting the head-body, sort of the trope of the removal of the head and the body operates in a similar fashion. Okay, so go back to the dark, i.e. our fear of a knife in the dark discloses the knife of darkness itself as a mirroring blade cutting through head and body, thought and experience, only to reveal in a blinding flash their essential unity. And this, I think, in a just kind of typical way, what happens when you are in a dark space, you sort of become hyper-aware of your own being. And maybe even the substantiality of something like thought, like all of a sudden you're really self-present in it. And that's what's really terrifying, right? Not having something else to occupy your attention, perhaps. Okay, such a uniting by separating of thought and experience is correlative to John of the Cross's description via the verbum absconditum heard by Eliphaz the Temanite in the book of Job, of the bodily disjointing, similar to the auto-dismembering dikr of some subcontinental Sufis, which accompanies mystical ecstasy, in which the soul-body nexus of human nature is strained like a knot being pulled from both ends. So if you can imagine the sort of soul-body are joined and they're being tensionally pressured, that, and they can, like a knot, you know, you can't ever pull the knot out, but this, so the knot is sort of like the disjointing of the mystical body, and there's some descriptions from Teresa of Avila as well of this concept, but again, it's John of the Cross who gives us this wonderfully clear definition of the phenomenon, and he writes, and this is also in the same work that Eugene was citing, the torment experienced in these rapturous visits is such that no other disjoins and endangers human nature. Indeed, it seems so to the soul in which this happens, that she is being loosed from the flesh and is abandoning the body. Actually, John is making this comment on the line, withdraw, beloved. It's also like the moment that Bataille was very much interested in when Angela Foligno screams and says, why unknown love, do you leave me, right? And this is the mystical subject actually has to tell God to go away because, you know, you're too big for me. You're going to kill me. That's kind of the idea. You're actually destroying my own human essence. The reason for this, John writes, is that such favors cannot be received wholly in the body. Thus the soul must in some fashion abandon the body, which obviously connotes a kind of ecstasy, like jumping out of the body. But it can never leave. It's not a liberation from the body. As a result, the body must suffer. And consequently, the soul in the body, it's still there, right? The soul in the body, because of their unity in one suppository, that is, in one individual substance, and this is, you know, hallmark of medieval Christian thought, the soul and body are joined in this way. Here, on this point, I feel that Eugene's use of the term unhuman must be tweaked to the inhuman, with the prepositional pun on the negation, so as to register that the human passes beyond itself from within, inside an exacerbated realization of its own nature as more and other than whatever it is. And also to register that the, you know, this the really heretical assertion of much mysticism is that humans are divine. that's when, you know, the mystic becomes a heretic, when they assert that they can become God, right? So Bataille defines the object of ecstasy in similar terms as the absence of an outside answer, the inexplicable presence of man. And we might enlarge this to say the inexplicable presence of anything, right? To bring it back to what Heidegger understands, the primary question of metaphysics, why something rather than nothing. Bataille says the inexplicable presence of man is the answer the will gives itself, suspended in the void of unknowable night. In other words, if the divine is the impossibility of the human, Eugene's words, it is only an intimacy with its own generic actuality or that. Not how the world is the mystical, but that it is, said Wittgenstein. The absolute intensification of that inversely throws the what into darkness, which has also thus a kind of structure of wonder or a suspension of what, right, and sort of therefore bleeds into something's factical intensity, or we could say that the maximization of that is darkness itself, right? That's why this Ur question of metaphysics is dark. You know, it's a never goes away. It's like, why is there something rather than nothing? That's an experience of darkness. That question. Note how this principle of maximal facticity corresponds to Dionysius' description of dark union with the divinity, that is, as he says, beyond assertion and denial. Here, Dionysius writes, he plunges, the contemplative, figured as Moses in his ascent of Mount Sinai, he plunges into the truly mysterious darkness of unknowing, in Calignem ignorantiae occidit vere mysticam. Here, renouncing all that the mind may conceive, wrapped entirely in the intangible and the invisible, he belongs completely to him who is beyond everything. Here, being neither oneself nor someone else, one is supremely united by a completely unknowing inactivity of all knowledge and knows beyond the mind by knowing nothing. I would note that the word occidit means falls or plunges. It also can mean to kill, but in this here, we don't have an object for the verb to kill, but it actually, the sense, we could say the suggested sense is that this is a kind of a violent act, right, which is at once a sort of death of the human and a death of God. Okay, so those are my, how are we for time? I should wrap it up. Okay, so I'm just going to pose quick three questions, sure, that I think are like in play in my response. One is, so the first question is, what is the relation between the distinction between thought and experience and this concept and tradition of divine darkness? Why do we need divine darkness to understand how our own being structures that you know, structures that distinction between thought and experience. My answer is that we sort of are cephalophores who don't know it yet. And the cephalophore, if you look at that quote by Plotinus, is, I think, also a great figure for panpsychism, right? And for a life which is certainly opens up this distinction, or exists in the opening, in the distinction between thought and experience. My second question is how does the dialectical work of darkness work now in contemporary discourses, given that the operation of darkness is to produce sort of absolute substances, new forms of matter, right? The dark materialism's event was very much about that. It's about potentiality. In some ways, it's also about not saying, you know, what it's a potential for, sort of leaving it open. And here I see real points of connection between sort of mystical discourse, language of unsaying, and places where we see kind of conjunction of philosophies of immanence and affects of incommunicability, sort of wearing black and talking about the immanent is something that contemporary philosophers are really good at. And so, pleasures, you know, we can cite certain examples. I think certainly Agamben's whole project of a science without an object is important, and his work Stanzas I see as crucial to the whole speculative, you know, medievalism's movement, and Laurel's, non-philosophy, and I think in terms of speculative realism, this sort of inhabiting of a vector of thought. There's a very affective reality to that, and I don't mean it in like subjective, you know, sort of emotional payoff way. I mean, in the medieval sense of the affectus, which is potentially, that which goes further than logic, right? Last question is, what does speculative medievalism have to learn from mysticism? What is the conjunction there? And my simple answer is that the mystics are beings who weaponize the correlation. They become weaponized correlations, and in a sense they shatter the mirror, and they wield the mirror as a knife against the world, as a sacrificial weapon. But somehow they also believe in the possibility of sort of breaking the mirror without breaking it, sort of shattering the mirror without violence. And I would just suggest that is the work of love to do that. Okay, sorry for taking too much
No,
time.
Thank you for those okay. comments, and also even throwing in your own jagged knife at the end by saying the work of love, which is one of those little explosive devices in our field. And it's also one of the great, I think, under-theorized subjects of the humanities today.